Okay, here we are.
Good. Before we begin, I mean, the actual interview itself, I have to give a prepared spiel that I do for every interview. And in your case, it will be embellished a little bit, but not much. And then we'll launch into the interview itself. Is that okay?
Yeah, it's fine.
All right. Jim, are you ready? Okay, we're going to start. Pardon me? Okay, and we'll start the interview. Hello, my name is Leroy Chatfield, director of the Farmworker Movement Documentation Project. This is another in a series of oral history interviews with former volunteers who worked for Cesar Chavez and his farmworker movement. Today, my guest is Marshall Gans, who worked with the farmworker movement from 1965 to 1981, a period of 16 years. This interview can be found in the Documentation Project website, www.farmworkermovement.us, in the oral history section. For the sake of the listener, before I begin this interview with Marshall Gans, I believe some disclosure is required. One, Marshall Gans and I have been friends since 1964, when he recruited me to become a member of the Bakersfield, California Friends of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, commonly called SNCC, or Friends of SNCC. This was more than a year before either of us joined the farmworker movement. And second, in 2004, I published an essay about the farmworker movement in which I wrote, quote, "In my view, Marshall Gans was the most accomplished and effective organizer in the United Farmworkers. No exceptions," end of quote. So with these personal disclosures made, I will begin the interview. Marshall, please give us your name. Tell us something of your background, including your education and your civil rights activities before you became part of the farmworker movement.
Okay. Boy, this sounds very formal, Leroy.
Well, let's start with your name.
Marshall Gans.
Good.
Yeah. This is an aside, but do you remember Marilyn Ginn, who was the Bakersfield Friends of SNCC person at all?
I remember the name.
Because her daughter turned up at the San Francisco book party. Yeah, it was really, yeah. Anyway, when you said Bakersfield Friends of SNCC, it reminded me of that. So background. I think of myself as growing up in Bakersfield, but I was born in Bay City, Michigan, and my father was a rabbi. My mother later became a teacher, and after 2 years in Bay City, we moved to Germany for 3 years after the Second World War when he was a chaplain in the Army. And I think it was an important time because the Holocaust experience was made real in terms of people I actually met, even though I was a small child. It had a sort of a presence, and my parents later interpreted the Holocaust for me as being a consequence of racism, not just anti-Semitism, with the simple lesson that racism kills. And I think that experience had certainly a lot to do with my getting involved in the farmworkers later, or with the civil rights movement first. We came back to the States within D.C. for 2 years when my father was looking for a congregation, and then moved to Fresno. And we were there for 2 years, and then to Bakersfield, where he was for an extended period of time, and where I finished high school. When I graduated from high school in Bakersfield in 1960, I'd actually met Leroy before that. We actually have a prior disclosure, Leroy, which is when you were the debate coach for Garces High School.
Oh, my. what a memory you have. What year was that?
Well, that must have been like 1958 or something.
That's correct. That's right.
because you were the debate coach, and I was on the with Mendel Overholt on the debate team at Bakersfield.
Bakersfield High School, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and your chief debaters were Craig Simpson and they were partners. I can't remember because Craig's father worked for Kern Land Company, as I recall. So, yeah, there's a lot of interesting stuff there. I ran across him years later. I was already back in Cambridge, but yeah. So when I finished high school, I had one goal was sort of to get as far from Bakersfield as I could, and got a scholarship to go to Harvard, and so started in 1960 at Harvard, which was both intimidating and exhilarating at the same time. It was, I'd never encountered elitism on that scale. I mean, you know, these people had gone to schools I'd never heard of. They all seemed to know each other, which they did, think they were entitled to the place and so forth. And if it's elitist today, then it was really something. But at the same time, it was intimidating. But at the same time, that was the year John Kennedy was elected president. He came to the yard shortly after his election, called, you know, for a new generation of leadership, and in some ways resonant with our own time right now, more so than any other time in between that I can recall. So it was, and 10% of the law school faculty left and went to work for his administration, and professors I was signed up for left and went to D.C., like Galbraith and Bundy and others. And so there was this, and it was also a moment of kind of the scales being removed from my eyes. I mean, you know, learning about like Cuba, for example, and just being opened up to a lot of different perspectives. And so I was there for 2 years trying to figure out what I was going to do. Came back and lived in San Francisco from 62 to 63, well, actually in Berkeley, because I had a girlfriend at Mills, and we were trying to figure out what to do, and that was also the time when the movement stuff was just heating up in the Bay Area, and I remember going to a Pete Seeger concert at the Longshoreman Hall in 1963, in which he did his sermon in song about civil rights, and it really made an impression on me, especially because he sung about the young people who were challenging things, and it began to make me uncomfortable because I began thinking, well, wait a second, if you share these values, then, you know, they're pretty courageous, and what are you doing here? And, of course, that was also then the summer of 63 was the March on Washington. I went back to school in Cambridge and found that my roommates were, one was in Harvard SDS, another one had been with SNCC the summer before, and there was momentum, and then the president was killed. Then John Kennedy was assassinated in November of that year. And I remember that as a very, very sobering moment, of course, because it sort of like you couldn't count. You sort of had to step up and take responsibility in a way. I mean, it wasn't like there was some father that was going to take care of everything for us. And Kennedy, of course, had his flaws, but it was the assassination was a shock in a way that others were not, because no president had been assassinated in my lifetime, and so it really sort of, I think, caused a lot of reflection by myself and others. And so in the course of that year, I met Dottie Zellner, who was an organizer for SNCC. Her husband, Bob Zellner, was one of the first white people in SNCC. He was from Alabama, a white Alabama in SNCC. And she was organizing Friends of SNCC in Boston, and I met her and became friends, and then began meeting the people who were actually doing this stuff in the South. And, you know, I had a lot of admiration for them, and it also reminded me of the fact that, you know, I had grown up on Passover Seders, and you know, as a rabbi's kid, you have no choice but to go to everything and listen and pay attention, at least until you're 13. But the story of the Exodus from slavery to freedom was every year the same, and but it was focused on the children. And there was one point in the Seder where they say something to the effect of, "You were a child. You were a slave in Egypt." And I had a hard time figuring that out until I realized that the claim was that this story isn't something that occurred one time, one place, to one people, but it's rather a story that repeats itself generation after generation. And clearly that's what was happening with the civil rights movement at that moment. And so the combination of meeting the people and sort of, you know, the understanding of the world I grew up with, and, you know, youth. I mean, I think Walter Brueggemann, who writes that prophetic vision, prophetic imagination is at the intersection of the critical and the hopeful. Young people come of age with a critical eye on the world, but also almost of necessity hopeful hearts. And I think that it's a reason that young people become involved in social movements, and it certainly was in my case. And so we discovered that Harvard had stock in Mississippi Power and Light Company, and so the SNCC people wanted to meet with us. And so a group of us in spring vacation drove down to Atlanta. I went to my first SNCC staff meeting, and it kind of blew me away. It was in Gammon Theological Seminary in Atlanta. And ironically, 2 years ago, summer before last, I was back in Atlanta leading a Camp Obama to train volunteers for the Obama campaign at Morris Brown College, which was right across the street from Gammon Seminary, where I hadn't been back in over 40 years. So it was kind of a nice closing of the loop there. But, you know, we walked into the sanctuary there of the seminary and expected to meet these serious revolutionaries, you know, doing graphs and charts, and instead they were having a preach-off. And I don't know if you know what a preach-off is. They were competing to see who could imitate Dr. King better. And there was a humor about the whole thing and a celebratory spirit that, along with the pain and the sacrifice, was just profoundly attractive. So that hooked me. And when I went back to Cambridge, then I pretty much decided I wanted to go work in the South. The summer project came along. I volunteered for that with Dottie's help. And then
that was 1964.
And that was June of 64, and went to Oxford, Ohio, and then was the night before we were due to leave to go to Mississippi is when Goodman, Cheney, and Schwerner disappeared, and we sort of all had a come to Jesus meeting with Bob Moses about, you know, how much did we really care about this. And it was a real moment of truth. Many years later, some folks made a movie about Freedom Summer called Freedom on My Mind, and they interviewed a number of us who were at that meeting that night with Bob, and almost everyone described it, you know, 30 years later, almost everyone described it almost identically. I mean, it was really like, what am I made of? Am I going to go? Am I not going to go? Because he confronted us with the choice and sort of said, look, I don't want you to go. I don't want to put you in danger. So if you can't go, please don't. There's no shame. But I really need you to go. And it was one of those moments that I think, you know, when you really try to figure out who you are and what you're made of and what you care about. So the next day, everybody went. I mean, there wasn't anybody that didn't. But the whole journey into Mississippi was not just an encounter with organizing and civil rights, but also with self, you know, I think in a really deep way, of, you know, sorting out what, and for many of us, I think, sorting out, you know, who we were, what we were called to do. And so it was in Mississippi, that working there, that I really it's when I first understood there was such a thing as organizing and felt called to it. And I was called to it, I think, there was something about the way in which it involved working with people, the way in which it coupled changing oneself and changing the world, the two together. It wasn't like, you know, policy stuff in Washington trying to change the world from on high, nor was it about, sort of taking care of, you know, somebody by providing some books or helping somebody in some way like that. But it was about both supporting and challenging people to exercise their own agency to change their circumstances in concert with others, but in a way that would transform the institutional context in which they had been constrained. And so that coupling, to me, was very powerful. So that when I worked with a 104-year-old man named Ben Faust, who had been actually born a slave, and wanted to do one thing before he died, which was register to vote. And he was selected to be the first person to go in Amite County and register to vote, that was transformational for everyone in the community, but also for the country, because it was part of a much bigger project of reclaiming voting rights for African Americans in the South. So it had a real, it also opened my eyes to the significance of power, you know, the fact that all these inequalities between blacks and whites were, you could bring books or a few medical supplies, it wasn't going to change anything as long as blacks couldn't vote, as long as they were economically marginalized, and as long as it was a daily routine. I hadn't had the experience of going up to someone twice my age who would stand up, offer me his chair, call me Mr., introduce himself with his first name, and not look me in the eye because I was white and he was black. And that was repeated thousands of times across the South daily. And so the combination of political, economic, and cultural powerlessness was clearly where you had to go. And so, I mean, what I learned from that was then that when you see inequality and inequities, you have to look at the power question. You have to look at people do not choose to live those ways. So you have to look at who's benefiting, who's losing, and what kind of conflict is going to be involved in changing it, because it's not win-win. It's except in some broad cosmic sense, but people who hold power don't relinquish it willingly. And so that was it, shaped the rest of my life in terms of political understanding. But then the other thing was that it was also clear that we couldn't go to Washington and ask for some power and expect to get it. It was clear that somehow power had to be created by the people who had the greatest interest in changing things, not those who didn't. And so our inspiration was the bus boycott, where every person in that community had a resource. They had bus fare. It wasn't power as long as they were using it individually and enriching the bus company, but once they used it collectively and withdrew it from the bus company, it became power, because it revealed the interdependency that's at the core of most social relations. And only it requires the people at the bottom end to get together and to make sacrifices in order to change things. This is Gandhi's, I think, fundamental insight. So the second thing it taught me about was about collective action and its relationship to power, and then that doesn't happen by itself. It's not like sunspots or the water. There's a craft involved in bringing people together to exercise power called leadership, and that the leadership in the civil rights movement was not just Dr. King. It was really thousands of people trained in churches and some unions and some black fraternals who had learned how to exercise leadership, and the organizers who were learning how to develop the leadership of others. And so those three things really came together for me: the focus on leadership development, on community building as a source of power. So when I left the South in 65, I had heard that there was a rent strike in California, and it sort of blew me away. And I saw a picture in a newspaper put out in San Francisco by Mike Miller, who was also at the book party, by the way, by Mike Miller, the movement, in which there was these people with rent strike signs in Tulare County, of all places, and there in the middle was this guy in a black suit that I remembered, and that was Leroy, and then brother Gilbert. And I thought, wow, this is amazing. And that newspaper arrived at E.W. Stepto's house in Enid County, Mississippi. So, you know, I kind of knew something was up, and a number of us were trying to figure out what to do about economics in the civil rights movement, and organized a workshop at Highlander School with unions to see about union organizing. Of course, the only unions that would send it to anybody was the UE and the packing house workers, but it was at least an idea that there was a thing called unions. So then I got back home. Now, I skipped the period when I was after the Democratic Convention, when Leroy and I, when you and I did the Friends of SNCC thing, between going back to the South and first and second time. But when I got back to Bakersfield, the grape strike was on. And Leroy, I think you were one of the first people I saw, and you by that time had done the Freedom Summer, the Farmer Crew Freedom Summer thing at Friendship House in Bakersfield, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. you met Caesar, and you told me about Caesar, and you know, I mean, the interesting thing for me was that I'd grown up in Bakersfield, but never really seen the farm worker world. For me, I had to go to Mississippi and, get educated about race and power and politics to see this community of people of color that had no political power, little economic power, and subject to the same kinds of patterns of discrimination and segregation that in California go back to the Chinese. And so it was like getting what we call Mississippi eyes to be able to see the world in which I'd grown up. And your introduction to Caesar and Mike's introduction to Caesar then sort of led me on to a weekend driving Caesar around San Francisco, him checking me out and me trying to figure things out, and then, he asked me to work with him, and I wanted to, and did. And so then that's how all that began.
Mm-hmm.
That was
mm-hmm.
a long answer to a short question.
Well, that was a very interesting answer, and very helpful. What prompted you, if anything, to leave SNCC or Mississippi and that work? Or what was what was that transition?
Well, with SNCC, in the summer of 64, we had organized the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party and gone to Atlantic City and challenged the regular Democrats and had high hopes of unseating the white Democrats in Mississippi. We're on our way to victory when Lyndon Johnson stepped in, who didn't want to antagonize the South and reversed everything. And that was kind of a moment of recognition about, gee, politics is a serious thing here. I mean, it's not enough to have three people killed and all this. It's like there's even deeper power issues here. So when I went back to the South, it was a bit sobered and focused on organizing. And as that got underway, SNCC was undergoing a big internal crisis because it walked into a leadership vacuum. I mean, Bob Moses had been providing most of the leadership in the whole Mississippi project. He left. He resigned. Whether it was a breakdown or he'd had enough or it was a combination of things, but he exited. And the organization had suffered a lot of shocks from the summer before with all the white kids coming in and Northern blacks and the Mississippi crew. And so there were a lot of tensions, as you might expect. And there really was no, as an organization, it like lost its way. And so we were working in our local projects, doing good stuff, but at the center, it was getting more and more confusing. And, you know, so on the one hand, I was in Macomb, then I was over in Indian County and lived with E.W. Stepniel for almost a year and learned so much. And we actually, when the Voting Rights Act passed, we actually broke the barriers in that county. And so that was an enormous source of satisfaction and a sense of accomplishment. By the way, Mr. Steptoe's granddaughter turned up at the book signing in L.A., so he's a little ghost from the past. But so it was a weird deal where on the one hand we were being quite effective, on the other hand the center was disintegrating. And so that's kind of, it got so frustrating. I mean, that's why I was in search of what to do next. And I had thought about going back to school. That wasn't so interesting. Then we did this union thing, and then I connected with the farm workers. And so, but I don't know if you recall, but I was still working for SNCC. And Mike Miller and I went to a SNCC staff meeting in November of 65. And see, at that time, it was still indeterminate what it was going to be. And one possible future for SNCC was that it would be kind of a network of radical organizers working in different venues. So we proposed that I be SNCC's person with the farm workers. And so the organization agreed. And so for about the first 6 months or so that I was working with the farm workers, I was technically the SNCC field secretary assigned to the farm workers. And I was earning the salary of $10 a week as opposed to the dollar a week or so people were getting at that point. So I was, you know, I was in, you know, hog heaven there. But
you were in the chips, right?
Yeah, I was in the chips.
Okay, good. This brings us now to your work, beginning of your work with the farm worker movement as assigned by SNCC to do this work, and you were there for 6 months, more or less, under the umbrella of SNCC. And during one of your very first assignments, I'm sure you had others, but that I remember, that it was in the March of 1966, and this is about 5 months after the start of the Delano grape strike, the farm workers decided to stage a march from Delano to Sacramento, to Sacramento, which was the capital of California, a distance of about 230 miles. What was the purpose of this march, as you recall and think about it? What was your assignment in organizing this major event, and how old were you at this point?
Well, let's see. When I started with the farm workers in 65, I was 22.
Mm-hmm.
And so I must have been 22 and turned 23, I guess, in the course of the march. Well, when I first went to work with the farm workers, my first assignment, and I don't know, Leroy, you may have had something to do with this, but my first assignment was really as an organizer, not to be involved in the strike in Delano, but to go open the Bakersfield office.
Mm-hmm.
And that was actually a really good thing for me because Manuel Chavez came down and gave me some instruction in house meetings in Manuel's way. And but it sort of put me right in the community. It forced me to feel the pressure to learn Spanish like quick because I couldn't understand what was going on in the meetings, and that was really painful. And it sort of took me back to learning about house meetings, learning about the death benefit, learning about the sort of basic stuff that Cesar and them had built the association with in the first place. So that was kind of cool. But I was doing Bakersfield stuff and Lamont and all that, but then Cesar called that meeting at Rosemary Quiroga's house in Santa Barbara, you know, I guess in about February, to consider what to do, given the fact the Schenley boycott had been called in December. People had been sent out, there'd been picket lines in front of the, you know, stores around Christmas, but nobody knew if that was going to work. You know, there was the spring season was going to come, and, you know, was everybody going to come back and work in Delano? And things were pretty desperate. I mean, you know, I always have in my head the image of people picketing grapevines in the tule fog of the valley, when you often could barely see the vine you were picketing, let alone the people pruning deep in the fields. I mean, it was very, very depressing circumstance. And so we all went over to Santa Barbara to sort of, that was wise, you know, a little better weather, trying to figure out what to do. And it's out of that meeting that the idea of the march came. And it was a combination of things. I actually write about it in my book because it was so interesting the way it evolved from this idea of taking farm workers to New York to stage a labor camp in front of Schenley's headquarters, to turning that into sort of going by bus across the country so it could be an organizing of the boycott thing, to, well, maybe it should be San Francisco because it's closer and Schenley's headquarters is there, and, well, you could march there, you know, because you could do maybe 15 miles a day, somebody who was an Army veteran said, and that way go up the valley and organize farm workers at the same time as putting pressure on Schenley to support the strike and not come and work in Delano. And then that morphed into, let's go to Sacramento and put the pressure on the governor instead of Schenley, because we may be able to leverage our influence more with the governor, and at the same time, you know, we can promote the boycott. But nobody really believed in the boycott that much, to then realizing that it was going to be Lent and that we could start the march at such a time that it would arrive in Sacramento on Easter Sunday. And so it went through this whole evolution from being a boycott tactic to being this really profound profound call to a kind of cultural awakening in the Latino community, in the Mexican community in California, as well as the farm worker world. And, you know, with the moral content of the moral content made explicit through the religious expression that was involved. So it turned into an extraordinary thing from one little tactic. And so Chuck Gardner and I were asked to coordinate it. And so that was my first job out of Bakersfield when I was asked to do that. And Chuck had this old Volvo, and we went, it wasn't as old as Caesar's Volvo, but we went driving up and down the valley making maps, you know, figuring out, you know, where we would go and all that and how we would do it. And I think, Leroy, I think you were in the city and were charged with raising support of different kinds. I think you were in L.A. or San Francisco at the time.
San Francisco.
Yeah. But we started gearing up for this thing, and as was one of the real elements of creative genius, I think, on Caesar's part, and what was timing, really appreciating timing and its significance, because we had been lobbying to get these Senate committee hearings held, but mainly to get Bobby Kennedy to come on the Senate subcommittee, which he was on migratory labor with Walter Mondale. And Harrison Williams. And we had been lobbying to get Kennedy to come. I mean, our friends, you know, in the UAW, Paul Schrade and others. Paul, by the way, was also at the LA Book Party. This is really wild. So the way the timing worked was that the hearings were going to be held on March 16th, and Kennedy did agree to come, and so that made it a major press event, and it turned out to be a really great event because of the way he took on the sheriff, and it sort of was like an enactment of what people thought was in Alabama in California. And so that day we passed out leaflets that the march was going to start the next morning, and the strategy being to hang on to the press so that they would be there when we started the march the next morning. That was March 17th, St. Patrick's Day. I don't think that had any significance, but who knows. And so then that was how the timing came together so beautifully, because then the next morning when we gathered to start the march, and I think it was like 87 people between the ages of 63 and, I don't know, 16. When we gathered to start the march, the Delano police decided to set up a line and block us for, you know, marching without a permit, a parade permit. And so across the country went pictures of Delano police with their helmets looking like Selma, Alabama, blocking the farm workers from marching. And boy, that just made the march. And so, you know, the convergence of factors here was really very, very powerful. But my job with Chuck had been to plan it and to, you know, figure out the timing in the towns and how to, you know, develop support logistics and how to deal with meals and all this, what to do in each town. So it became a whole ritual of finding a committee in a town that would host us, charging them with providing food and housing. Some of it, of course, supported from the outside as well, but really there, because the idea was to build local leadership in the course of the march. Then they would produce a group of musicians to welcome the march to town at the edge of town. And then there would be a procession, and often led by a mariachi or a taka-taka or some, through the barrio, and then wind up in the park for food and a big rally. And at the rally, Luis Valdez would read the Plan de Delano, the sort of our equivalent of Zapata's Plan de Ayala, the liberation plan. People would come forward and be enlisted, and the teatro would put on farmworker theater stuff. Caesar would speak, and then the next morning there would be a mass at which the Lady of Guadalupe banner carried at the front by a farmworker from the previous town would be handed off to a farmworker from that town who would take it to the next town. So each place sort of had this rhythm to it. And left in its wake organization that hadn't been there before. That had a, you know, long-term impact on the valley. But so our job was to coordinate that stuff and work with the folks in the cities, but also to, you know, work with those farm worker groups. Manuel Chavez had a kind of advance crew that would go ahead a few days and try to create the groundwork, but it was very much, we were like one day ahead of ourselves for the most part, except for Sacramento, where we tried to actually do much more, well, we had to do more advanced planning. But it taught me something, too, about how to operate, you know, how to operate in the moment. I mean, it's like the kind of training that people get on political campaigns if they do advance work. I mean, it's like you just have to figure out how to make it happen and find the resources to make it happen. And I think that, in a sense, that was one of the underlying strengths of the farmworker movement, was that we had people who could do that. I mean, that was sort of a valued capability of being creative on the spot, figuring out how to use what was at hand to make whatever it was you were trying to make happen. And I think it was something that was born of necessity that then became something of real, a real asset, a real value, because it was, you know, capacity to maneuver, to be agile, and appreciate the value of creativity. So, yes. So the march was, the other thing about the march was, it was also, for me, it was sort of my introduction to Roman Catholicism. I mean, the first time I'd read any Christian scripture was in college, in a philosophy class in which I read St. Paul and Augustine and Aquinas, but yeah, I didn't go too deep. When I really got some appreciation of Christian teaching was in the Baptist churches of the South, where because the movement was so deeply rooted in the living, a living faith, and it was I found that I got it because I had been raised in a religious family and understood something of Scripture, and so at one point I was even recruited to teach Baptist Sunday school for a little while in Mississippi, and something my father would have been shocked or surprised, but my Old Testament studies served me in surprising good stead, but in the March it was like. It was an extraordinary time in the Catholic Church. I don't have to tell you, Leroy. I mean, you know, Vatican II had happened, and I know the Christian Brothers had not caught up with things, but there was a kind of a light beginning to break at that period, and the Kosciuszko movement was around, and there were priests like Father Kenny and others who had been part of the California Mission Band trying to bring the church into support of farm worker organization for many years. And so the whole thing of the Mexican, the way in which the faith was rooted in the people, as distinct from the church establishment, was also really interesting to me. And so the whole language of the Mass, of Our Lady and what she represented, Stations of the Cross that we did on the levee leading to Sacramento, the Easter Vigil the night before. We entered Sacramento when we were camped at, I think it was St. Joseph's School, Our Lady of Grace or something.
Our Lady of Grace.
Our Lady of Grace is sort of camped across the river from the city, sort of like the Israelites, you know, on the other side of the Jordan. And then watching Roberto Roman, who had carried this 2x4, this cross made of 2x4s, wrapped in black, he carried it from Delano all the way. Watching him stay up and rewrap it in white, decorate it with flowers, and then the next day lead the march across the river bridge into Sacramento barefoot, carrying his flower-laden cross. It was amazing, so for me it was like an introduction to that whole world, which then of course was a very important world for the farmworker movement. And I never felt put off by it. I felt quite the opposite. I felt appreciative of the window and of the language, and by that I mean the resource. That faith was for people in terms of solidarity and courage and what it takes in order to take the risks involved in making change. So that was certainly one of the big things I took away from that.
Mm-hmm. I want to just go back to a little of the nitty-gritty of the march logistics. What kind of staff did you have at your disposal?
Staff. Yeah, let's see. there was me and Chuck.
Who?
Me and Chuck Gardner.
Oh, Chuck Gardner. Okay.
Yeah, see, we were the co-coordinators, me and Chuck.
Okay.
And then, let's see, Luis was working on the Plan de Delano along with Eliezer Risco.
Okay, so Luis Valdez.
Okay. Yeah, but he wasn't my... But they were working on sort of the... You know, yeah, the Plan de Delano, the manifesto, and all that.
And the teatro stuff.
Yeah, the teatro, yeah, because they were sort of in charge of the, you know, the cultural, the non-religious cultural content.
Okay,
and,
all right.
Sort of the Mexican cultural content to it. But, you know, Peggy McGivern became the nurse. We organized a structure within the march. In other words, there was this question of choosing a march captain, because one thing I understood was that we really needed to have a core of leadership that was well organized, that could coordinate the march in progress. So I'm not talking about, you know, the preparations, but...
No, I'm talking about the march in progress, yeah.
You know, well, the march in progress we needed a march captain and captains. And it was very interesting because we invited the AWOC people to participate in the march. And, of course, AWOC's leadership, you know, wanted nothing to do with it, Al Green and so forth, but the people did. And so the strikers chose an AWOC leader to be the march captain, Manuel Vasquez, which was quite remarkable and a very good thing to do. So there was Manuel, there was Robert Bustos, Pete Cardenas, and a few others who were kind of the core leadership team in managing the people.
Well, let's stop here a minute because I want to make the record clear. Roberto Bustos writes about that he was elected to be the captain of the march. Is that not accurate?
I think Manuel was chosen. Now maybe I just wondered, did Manuel turn it down? I don't think so.
Manuel looks to me to be like a lieutenant in the scheme of things. Now, I wasn't there on the day-to-day, but when I review the photographs and I review the written materials, it just seems that Roberto Bustos was the person at the front, so to speak. I'm just raising that. That's all.
No. It's funny because I have the memory too that I was always working with Roberto, and Roberto and Pete. But I also remember this thing where they chose Manuel, unless I have it confused with some other event. But I think it was this event where Manuel was chosen. It's an interesting question. I'm not sure.
I don't know. There's something that I can easily double check, but I would certainly have to do that. And then there was another story along those lines that someone else was chosen to lead the march, but because of the Virgin Banner, he could not do that or would not do that.
I wonder if that was Manuel.
No, I think it was, why is his name escaping me, from McFarland.
Epifanio Camacho? Epifanio would definitely have had objections.
Epifanio.
Yeah, Epifanio Camacho. He would definitely have had objections to the Virgin Banner, no question about it. Yeah, I don't remember that, but that could well be.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, who else on the day-to-day marching that you worked with, all different aspects of the day-to-day march? We've mentioned Luis Valdez, Elisa Risco, Peggy McGivern, who was the nurse.
Yeah, she was in charge of blisters. She was the chief blister officer. Terry Cannon from the movement was doing our publicity. He was our PR, our press person.
When you say and, the movement?
The movement newspaper,
okay.
SNCC.
Okay.
Yeah, Terry was editor of the movement and was worked with Mike in San Francisco, and Terry came down to be the press secretary, and we had this VW van that had a phone in it, which was then very, very exotic. And so, you know, that was part of the deal.
Mm-hmm.
See if I can remember now, because there was me and Chuck, Robert, and the captains. Manuel had a team that was going ahead doing advance work.
Manuel Chavez.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Kathy Murguia?
I mean, I know Kathy was there. I can't remember in terms of a specific role, although, I mean, that could just be my memory.
What about the
I do remember, but I remember talking to you about things like, what was it? things like, it wasn't tents, but it was things like that, or sleeping bags or something. I remember talking with you about the preparations for Sacramento especially, and about how that was going to work and what was needed. And I think you may also have, did you design the prayer card that was given out?
No, I did. No, I did not.
Because we had a little card that had the Virgin on one side and then Boycott Shenley on the other side. It was given out everywhere. Somehow I connected that with you.
What about the
photographers? Well, it was all, you know, I mean, that was a great thing, how you know, well-documented the whole thing was. But I think John Lewis, I remember John in particular, who I also saw at the book party in San Francisco last week. It's really been kind of amazing, deja vu. Yeah, I remember John in particular on the march, but, you know, there
and
were...
And George Ballas. George Ballas.
George, yeah. And, I mean, I don't know if John Koons was around for that. Was he?
John Koons was around for... Yes, he was. He was around for it.
Well, and Fats always took pictures. You know, Manuel Sanchez always took pictures. But I'm trying to think, oh, what about the woman... Kathy something. I'm blanking.
You're not talking about Kathy Lynch now.
No. There was a woman photographer.
I don't know. You got me here.
Bob Fitch, I know. Bob did some of the best photography, I think, that was done. I'm not sure if he did march photography. I don't remember.
I think he came later. I think his work was later, I think.
So then it was mostly probably John Lewis and Ballas and Koons.
Yes. They were certainly the stalwarts. I haven't come across any photos from the Kathy that you mentioned that I'm aware of. But I mean it's not a big issue. It's just that I'm trying to give the listener some sense of the staffing, such as it was, that was critical to the day-to-day activity of the march itself, getting from Delano to, I mean, where did people sleep?
Yeah, I mean, well, every town, it required finding a local committee that would produce food, a place to sleep. Now, sometimes it was people's homes, but more often it would be like a church hall, or a gym, or a veterans hall, or something like that. It meant finding local musicians. It meant challenging the local priest to participate, which he sometimes did, but mostly didn't. It meant arranging in these pretty hostile towns, for the most part, arranging for march permits and park permits and the equipment needed to hold a rally and have sound and light at night. And so there was the generator, the need for generators and power sources and all that. Security issues like, you know, both, well, mainly to sort of keep, you know, so that people were on the lookout for folks trying to cause trouble, preparing the evening dinner, then preparing breakfast and packing a lunch. I remember that. They had to both provide breakfast and pack a lunch for the next day. Mm-hmm. Seeing to the provision of water and stops in between. I mean, some really, like outside Cutler or Rossi, I think there was somebody out with a silver punch bowl offering water to the farm workers passing. Mm-hmm. There was some very, you know, kind of cool stuff like that, but toilets. There was the question of porta potties, and you know the march had to have that. So you know, as you're reminding me, I mean there was a whole infrastructure that it takes to move an army.
That's right.
And as the army grew, the demands on the infrastructure grew too. So it became more and more demanding as time went on, and I wish I could remember more of the people who were, you know, playing key roles in that. part of it.
I don't want to leave out the local police issues that you confronted.
Well, no. I'm sorry, go ahead.
That you confronted in each little town as you went up the valley.
Yeah, you always have to figure out how to maneuver to get get permits. Now, it was interestingly, although, you know, Governor Brown was very, very ambivalent about the whole thing. But, you know, he was a Democrat. He was up for re-election. We had a bit of an encounter with him at the CDC convention in Bakersfield just a little while before the march began, where we were trying to get the California Democratic Council to endorse the boycott, and Willie Brown made this amazing pitch, one of the best pitches I've ever heard. We raised all this money off the floor. But we were also picketing Governor Brown for not, I think Dolores and I got in trouble with Caesar over that, because we were picketing Governor Brown for not, you know, coming out in support of the strike or intervening or whatever. So there was a sub theme there. But when we got stuck with the march and the cops were stopping us from marching, and it was through the governor's office with the highway patrol that the highway patrol intervened, mm-hmm. if I'm remembering it correctly. And then the highway patrol actually served as kind of a buffer for us with a lot of the local authorities. Mm-hmm. And that turned out to be really very helpful. And, of mm-hmm. course, they became friends. You know, I mean, that's what happens in the course of that. And so there was this whole issue of whether you could march on freeways and, you know, would we have to go 30 miles out of our way or be able to march on the freeway for a short period. And they were quite helpful with that. So mm-hmm. even though the governor, you know, blew it on the day we got to Sacramento, there was enough support there that it helped ease the problems with the local authorities, which would have been enormous without that, I think, and they were challenging even with that.
Mm-hmm. And the march grew and grew as it went up the valley, and when it arrived in Sacramento, press reports say 10,000 people. Does that sound about right?
Well, yeah. I mean, that was the number that everybody said. I mean, who knows? But, you know, by the time we got to Fresno, we had 2,000. Mm-hmm. And then by the time we got to Stockton, that was where Shenley called. I mean, that was amazing. I was sitting with Caesar in St. Mary's Square there in Stockton, sort of also known as Wino Park, and there was a little CSO office on the square, and somebody came running over to tell Caesar that Shenley's lawyer was on the phone and wanted to talk to him, and he thought it was a joke, and it took like three times for him finally to go to the phone and find Sidney Korshak on the other end saying that Shenley wanted to settle. And so, you know, asked permission to leave the march and went with Chris to L.A. and Chris Hartmeyer met with Shenley and the Teamsters, who were also at Korshak's house. I mean, these bizarre juxtapositions. Here's Caesar, and then, you know, this very shining morning-faced Protestant clergyman and a bunch of Teamsters and Bill Kircher, and they're all at Sidney Korshak's house in Beverly Hills. It's just bizarre. But when it settled, I was with the march outside Lodi, and when we got the word, we stopped the march, and Terry climbed up on top of the little van, the news van, and made the announcement in English, and then it was translated to Spanish, but people started applauding in English because they understood what it meant. So, of course, that was a huge infusion of energy that came, you know, just a few days out of Sacramento. And so by the time we got to, you know, the Our Lady of Grace, I don't know how many people were there that night, but it was in the thousands, at least a couple thousand.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and then the next day into Sacramento, you know, with a contract. you know, I've often wondered, well, I haven't wondered that much, but I mean, it just, again, it felt like providential, you know, the timing of the whole thing was really extraordinary.
Okay, well, I'm
really... Oh, one other thing.
Go ahead.
Another thing that happened in the march was that De Colores became the song of the... See, up to that point, the only songs we had, Luis's songs, some of them were translations of civil rights songs, and then there was like Huelga en General, some of them were adaptations of corridos and things like that. But the union itself didn't really have its own song. And I think, you know, I mean, music plays a big role in movements for a whole variety of reasons. And the fact that the Cursillistas were involved in that march and supportive all along the way, and especially in Sacramento, because Our Lady of Guadalupe Church there, Father Kenny had a very active Cursillo group because they had the big the chickens and the roosters on the front lawn of the church. I remember sort of the gallo and the kitty-kitty pollo and so forth. But so that song became really the union song in the course of that. And the Cursillo people, especially in Sacramento, played this huge host role. And I just remember, there was something about Shinley provided beer. Now, I don't know, it's lost in obscurity. There's some story about that I can't remember, but I did want to just mention the way that De Colores became the song of the farmers.
It became sort of like the anthem of the movie.
It really became the anthem. It became the anthem, and it's so interesting because it says nothing about struggle. It says nothing about liberation. It says not, you know, it celebrates the wonders of God in the world. I mean,
that's right.
You know,
yeah,
and so it's.
It's very simple to sing too, and it's just pleasing. It's a pleasing song.
Well, and it has, and I think there's a deep the part of the affinity is because it does celebrate the nature. The little things of nature, and of course, that's what farm work is. You know, and. So I think there's a resonance there. The simplicity of it, I think, is also kind of resonant with the content of the movement as well.
Mm-hmm.